Federal regulators halted construction of the 604-mile Atlantic Coast Pipeline on Friday. It's the second natural gas pipeline under construction in West Virginia to receive a stop work order in the last month. Federal officials also shut down construction of the Mountain Valley Pipeline. In both cases, officials cited recent rulings by the federal U.S. Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals as the reason for halting work. Since getting the green light from federal regulators last year, more than a dozen lawsuits have been filed challenging the two major pipelines. They touch on everything from landowner rights to compliance with a slew of federal laws. Ellen Gilmer is a legal reporter who has been following litigation for E&E News, a Washington, D.C.-based news organization that covers energy and environment issues. Reporter Brittany Patterson spoke with Gilmer about some of the recent decisions and how the courts are fundamentally changing the natural gas pipeline build-out that's occurring in Appalachia.
Ellen, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
Thanks for having me.
So you've been covering environmental legal issues for about 5 years now. Have lawsuits related to pipelines become a bigger part of your beat?
Oh, definitely. Pipelines have gotten way more attention in recent years, both in the public debate and in the courtroom. And because I cover the courtroom, that means I've been really busy tracking those issues. We obviously saw a lot of public debate over the Dakota Access Pipeline and Keystone XL. Still, we're seeing that. Those are big oil pipelines. Now we're seeing natural gas pipelines get that same or at least a similar kind of attention in a more regional way. So we're seeing a lot of opposition and scrutiny to these projects as they're built out across the country.
Yeah. Well, and just to give a little context here, we're talking about the 303-mile Mountain Valley Pipeline and the 600-mile Atlantic Coast Pipeline. Because they cross state boundaries, they're regulated by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC. How does having FERC involved change things?
So when FERC has oversight over a pipeline, the pipeline is subject to a very lengthy review process in which the commission determines whether the project is needed and what kind of environmental impacts it will have. And that review process can open a lot of new angles for litigation from any pipeline opponents, meaning they can go through that review process and find various elements of it in which they think FERC dropped the ball, didn't look at an area close enough.
These pipelines require a lot of different federal permits from different federal agencies. Those permits have played a major role in some of the recent litigation. Could you take us through some of the most recent decisions?
Sure. So when an interstate natural gas pipeline gets approved, it has to go through that FERC process. The pipeline also has to get approvals from other federal agencies, just depending on when it triggers that jurisdiction. So, for example, if it crosses major waterways or wetlands, the pipeline would need authorization from the Army Corps of Engineers. If it crosses national forest land, it would need permission from the Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management. And all of those things were at issue for the Mountain Valley Pipeline, which recently had permits were suspended for its waterway crossings in West Virginia. Additionally, permits were suspended for its crossing of a national forest, the Jefferson National Forest in Southern Virginia. And that was under the jurisdiction of BLM and the Forest Service. Even though those weren't the big overarching FERC permits for the project, they are still considered, you know, critical federal approvals of the project route. Now that those have been suspended, that creates problems for the pipeline to go forward.
Yeah, and now we're seeing that the court's ruling related to the Mountain Valley Pipeline's National Forest crossings have effectively shut down all construction, at least temporarily. Can you tell us a little bit about what FERC said in this case in order to issue that stop work order?
That's right. FERC issued a pretty surprising order, surprising to many people. FERC decided that construction on the whole pipeline should stop because if those agencies, when they go back and they go back to the drawing board like the court ordered them to do, if they decide that that route just isn't appropriate, the whole pipeline could have to change its route.
I think that's really interesting that this ruling triggered a stop work order when others have not. But I think it's also important to note that not all of the decisions out of the Fourth Circuit have sided with the pipeline opposition. It's been quite a mixed bag, right?
That's definitely true. Just last week, pipeline opponents lost a case where they were challenging state permits for the pipeline in Virginia. They've also lost a sweeping case that dealt with landowner rights along the pipeline's route. So it certainly hasn't been a situation where they've just been winning all these cases against Mountain Valley Pipeline or federal agencies or anyone. These recent decisions have been a real turn of the tide for them.
Are other pipelines across the country facing similar litigation and struggles?
So the other pipeline in the West Virginia and Virginia area, Atlantic Coast Pipeline, which we've also talked about, has also faced some similar struggles. The Fourth Circuit, again, decided that the Fish and Wildlife Service, another federal agency, didn't study enough the impacts that the pipeline could have on some endangered species and threatened species. It was considered a pretty big setback for the developers of the pipeline. In pipelines in other parts of the country, environmentalists and other pipeline opponents, landowner rights advocates, and people like that are definitely using every tool in their toolbox to oppose pipelines. And that's not new. They're looking at every federal review that surrounds a pipeline, every state review, everything that could have deficiencies.
So looking at the broader picture, I mean, are we seeing any indication that these rulings, especially the ones that we're seeing out of the Fourth Circuit, are fundamentally shifting how future natural gas pipelines will either be proposed or opposed?
I think the ground is shifting for opponents of natural gas pipelines in that they've seen some of these really specific challenges to federal review processes pay off. So they're going to keep using this playbook for future pipelines, and they're going to be going after all of these approvals for all of these other pipelines they're challenging.
And that has to make it hard for pipeline developers, right? I think we just saw the Mountain Valley Pipeline push back its operation date because of some of these court rulings, right?
It's definitely a risk for these pipeline operators and pipeline developers. They know now that they're going to be facing huge pushback in court. What we likely will see is pipeline developers pushing the federal agencies to make sure they have all their ducks in a row before they grant these approvals, because if those approvals are going to be struck down in court, then the pipeline developer has lost time. The future of pipeline battles going forward depends in part on how environmentalists are defining success. If success means they shut down a pipeline, I don't think the rulings that we've seen so far from federal courts suggest that that is likely to happen extremely soon. However, as we have seen in court, they are able to slow down pipeline construction, temporarily halt pipeline construction, and force agencies to take a closer look. And that way, they are really pushing that issue forward.
Well, Ellen, thank you so much.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
That was Energy and Environment reporter Brittany Patterson speaking with E&E News legal reporter Ellen Gilmer. Links to her reporting, as well as more information about how the federal courts are affecting natural gas pipelines, and a timeline of recent rulings can be found on our website, wvpublic.org. Our latest episode of Inside Appalachia highlights the life and work of a woman from Georgia named Shirley Sherrod. She's devoted her life to helping Black farmers in the South. Up next, we'll hear excerpts from this episode, a story produced by the Southern Foodways Alliance in 2015. The first voice that you'll hear is producer Tina Antolini, as Sherrod shows her the land that her family has farmed for generations.
Picture in your mind's eye a southern plantation. The antebellum mansion with its stately white columns and rocking chairs lined up on a broad veranda. A grove of hundreds of pecan trees tended by African Americans. Other Black men till fields on this 1,600-acre sprawl of land. We're in a part of Georgia where towns only occasionally break up mile upon mile of cotton fields. But there is one aspect of this plantation that disrupts the rest of the image, that refocuses it entirely. And that is the plantation's owner, who's driving me across the land. A 68-year-old Black woman named Shirley Sherrod.
You know, there's an area, and it happens to me often when I pass it, that all of a sudden the slaves, You know, it's like I can feel their presence. And I just wonder what happened there.
Shirley Sherrod is herself the descendant of slaves. And she was also once vilified across this country as an anti-white racist. But both those accusations and her involvement with this plantation, they're just the coda in a much bigger story of farming and race. In a moment in which so many institutions in this country, the police, housing, the legal system, are being exposed for longstanding racism, agriculture deserves attention too. This is Shirley Sherrod's story. But it's also a story of how racism contributed to the loss of millions of acres of land once held by black farmers.
My mother would always say that her father would say he would never borrow any money from Farmers Home Administration because it was just a way of taking black folks' land.
There's a printed sheet of paper thumbtacked to the wall in Shirley Sherrod's office that reads, "Yesterday is history, tomorrow is a mystery, today is a gift." It's the first thing I notice when I walk in, outside of Shirley herself, who's wearing a blouse printed with royal blue and purple peacock feathers. The slogan sticks with me because Shirley's history is one of lots of twists and turns, so many of which have informed her present. Her story of agriculture and race goes all the way back before she was born, back to 40 acres and a mule.
You know, coming out of slavery, and my great-grandfather and grandmother were slaves, black people understood many things were important, but two were very important: getting an education and buying land.
Land was the promise made to slaves at the close of the Civil War, 40 acres and a mule. It was a promise broken. But the idea that land could serve to root African-American communities, long lacking control over their own destinies, was something people put their faith in, including Shirley's family.
I actually found my grandmother's family in the 1870 census. They were sharecropping, and they worked together as a family to try to help each family member buy land. I would imagine in the end, maybe as much as 5,000 acres.
From nothing to 5,000 acres. This amassing of land is one of the great unsung success stories of African Americans in this country. By 1920, almost a million black farmers owned roughly 15 million acres of farmland. This is just decades after the end of slavery. And to get that land, they had to do more than save up money. They had to overcome the prejudice inherent in the Jim Crow South. Shirley's grandfather worked to buy the family farm from a white landowner by paying off the land little by little.
And when he took the last payment to him, he was feeling really, really happy, you know, that this was it. He's about to own this farm outright.
But the white landowner said, "Nope, you still owe more." And Shirley's grandfather was afraid to contradict him.
In the end, my grandfather had to leave there knowing he had paid for the land, but accepting that he still owed quite a bit of money on the land because the white owner said he did.
He went home and had to tell his family.
And my grandmother, who couldn't read and write that well, went to a box that she kept, because every time she washed clothes, whatever papers she found in his pocket, she put it in a box. So she pulled the box out, they went through the box and found every receipt.
So he could prove that he had indeed paid full for the farm.
He had paid for the land.
And amazingly, the white landowner accepted that proof. The farm was his.
That was Tina Antolini speaking with Shirley Sherrod. To hear the rest of the story and learn how Sherrod encountered and fought back against discrimination within the federal government's farm assistance programs, listen to our latest episode of Inside Appalachia. You can find it online at wvpublic.org or wherever you download your podcasts. Mm-hmm. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from West Virginia University, Concord University, and Shepherd University. Our producer is Glennis Board. I'm Chuck Anzalevich.